the volume.
What is going on? Happy Tuesday, maybe Wednesday, because it's a podcast. You can listen whenever you want. Three and Out. It's the name of the show. Me, John Middlecoff, here right after the, pretty bad Monday night game, Packers-Lions. But we watched it because the Packers were kind of in shambles and still arguably are after that first half. Have some thoughts about them right off the top. Lot going on in the NFL right now. We got Carson Wentz, who is just in shambles right now. We have the NFC East. Feels like the Eagles and Cowboys pulling away a little bit. Sam Darnold, little career resurrection. The Steelers, not looking good. The Raiders, not looking bad. Who would have thought? Things are changing fast. Of course, the Monday morning pod or the Monday podcast comes out on Monday morning exclusively on this feed. So if you missed exclusively on the 3 and Out feed, go subscribe, rate, review, leave 5 stars if you want. You can leave a question, leave a comment. I appreciate everyone that has. And hopefully everyone's enjoying football season because now we're in the full swing of things, right? Games galore. I feel like I lost my voice and I swear I haven't done anything for the last 48 hours. I've watched NFL, college, probably combined... I watched a bunch of games Monday morning, maybe 75 games. I mean, I have consumed a ton of football, and I'm not even footballed out yet. So that's a good sign. But it's only September. We got a long way to go. This is a marathon, not a sprint. What we just witnessed, what I just witnessed on the screen was not really that pretty for a half. And I would equate it to this. Anyone who has gotten to an argument for you married men out there, you get into an argument with your wife. For those of you in a serious relationship, argument with your girlfriend. Couple days later, you kind of move on. Things are, you go to dinner, you go to lunch, you go on with your day, you go to work, you come home. But there's just a tension in the air. Hell, maybe a week or two later, you just can't shake it. Sometimes, if you cross a line with what you said, it might not go away for a long period of time. That doesn't mean you can't go out to dinner with your friends. You can't go over to family's homes together. You can't hang out with each other. But there is a tangible tension in the air for an explosive fight that happened. We have all been a part of those. Some more than others. And you don't want to relive it. You do not want to talk about it. But it is the elephant in the freaking room. That's a little bit, I discounted or at least poo-pooed last week, the reason that they laid an egg against the Saints because of everything that happened in the offseason. And then watching tonight when the Packers in the first half, let's face it, look like crap. And Peyton Manning and Eli Manning even mentioned, it was a little weird after the game that he's still talking about the offseason. And it's like there was this, it won't go away. And Aaron hasn't exactly let it go away. And I have to at least acknowledge the fact that there might be something lingering. Now, they pulled away in the second half. They have Aaron freaking Rodgers and Devontae Adams, and they're playing the Lions. But that half of football after, to come into this game at home and look like that, to me is a little alarming. The other thing that's alarming about the Packers is they fire their defensive coordinator and they go hire Joe Barry, who, check his resume. He's not exactly Vic Fangio or Monty Kiffin. And I think we've seen tonight, I don't know if he's going to be that great of a defensive coordinator. Now, is it all his fault? Is there personnel? It doesn't exactly parallel the 85 Bears. Yeah, I would agree. They don't have, Reggie White ain't walking through that door. But I don't exactly look at Joe Barry as a guy keeping Sean McVay, keeping Kyle Shanahan, keeping Bruce Arians and Leftwich and Brady up at night. And I think next week, I'm a little bit out of a loss with the Packers. I thought coming into the season, they are a powerhouse. They're going to compete with the top teams in the NFC. And more than likely, they have every bit the chance to represent the NFC in the Super Bowl. Like they were going to win 13, 14 games and just cruise. I don't think that anymore. Because I think it's fair to now kind of just, let's call it what it is. The offseason has bled into their regular season now. They're missing a couple players on defense. Maybe they're just not quite as talented. Maybe Aaron, just a year older, didn't focus that much this offseason. I do think that's fair to have that discussion. And ultimately, when he walks in the room and Gutekunst and those guys just see each other, it's just got to be a little weird. Like, the other players in the locker room know what's happened. Now, if they come to San Francisco next Sunday night and blast the Niners, I'll go, listen, they've gotten past it. They talked about, you know, whatever the argument it is, they're in a good headspace. But if they go to San Francisco, a team that 2 years ago, when the Niners were good, blasted them twice, destroyed them once on Sunday Night Football, and then clowned them again in the NFC Championship game. So if the Packers can't come into this game approaching it kind of like a Super Bowl atmosphere and a mindset of, we need to beat this team when they're right. Last year, the Packers beat them, but the Niners had 17 players on the COVID list and C.J. Beathard, Nick Mullins playing quarterback. It was like the JV squad. This is the real squad. And for the Packers who kind of want to get the mojo back, I do think it's important this Sunday night to play well. And from what I saw tonight in that first half, that is not playing good football. So I got the Green Bay Packers red flagged. Also, one other thing. Gronkowski went on with Peyton and Eli, and he said he didn't watch film. And I immediately get a text from an executive in the league that says, these guys, man, Gronk and Brady are always pulling these secret punches. He's like, they love throwing this crap out. He's like, I bet Gronk watched 3 or 4 hours today on their upcoming opponent. Tom Brady, this offseason, talked about, like, we got to cancel OTAs. He's like, my team, we canceled one of our OTAs because Brady was making this big deal of it. He goes, and then Brady has his entire team to this compound, and they throw. It's a competitive advantage for Brady. Now, Gronk is, like, trying to put a message out there to all the young tight ends, like, you don't need to watch football. Just go make plays. Meanwhile, Gronk, probably today, worked out, reviewed the film from yesterday, and got a jump on his opponent. These guys are using mental warfare against the rest of the NFL to take advantage of it. What Brady learned from Belichick and then gave to Gronk, they're now using in Tampa against the entire league. It's genius. We all laugh. Like, oh, it's just Gronk being funny. Gronk doesn't watch film. Yeah, I think that's a bold-faced lie. I know everyone in the NFL thinks it's a bold-faced lie. The problem is a lot of players in the NFL that idolize these guys they don't think it's a lie. They actually think they're telling the truth, and then they're going to copy them. Because usually when you aspire to be someone in life, you just follow, read about, talk to them, listen to their words, and then you copy it. And these guys constantly put out things, not Tom necessarily, but Gronk does, like a messenger for Tom. And they're just playing head games with the rest of the NFL. They also got a big game this week in LA. Can't wait. We got some big NFC matchups, NFC West matchups this Sunday. Can't wait. Let's dive into old Carson Wentz. And I think we have an official problem. Let's face it, we already knew this. When I was at Fresno State, most head coaches just have like some core values. And they're usually like plastered on the locker room, just all over the building. And they tend to be pretty basic stuff. And I remember one of Coach Hill's most just fundamental program philosophies was be there. Be there. Think about that. And you know, most of us young people, late in our teens, early in our 20s, if you play sports, if you have a mentor in business, they'll teach you early on that just showing up consistently, not being there early, not being the best once you show up, just showing up. So when that meeting happens, when that interview happens, when whatever happens, if you are there, you will separate from more than half the people. That's not factoring in any talent. Then if you're talented, whatever you're doing, you'll separate from more. I'm just talking about being there. Being there. Herm Edwards, I think, famously said, the best ability is availability. Like, when you're not available in anything, whether it's football, hell, whether it's podcasting, Colin brings me to the volume. What if all of a sudden, 2 straight weeks, like, Colin, I got some stuff going on. I don't think I can do the pod for Tuesday. First time, you'd be like, hey, no problem, man. Whatever. We'll make it. We'll figure it out. What if then the following week, I'm like, Colin, Friday, it's going to be hard for me to record anything. I'm playing golf, and then I got this other meeting. I don't have any time. You'd be like, if I did that 3 or 4 times, I mean, he's like, well, we got to end this business relationship. anyone that's listening right now in any walk of life, in any different industry, knows the importance of being able to rely on the people you're in business with. And in football, you are clearly, when it comes to your quarterback, once you start paying him a lot of money, you are in a very expensive business deal with that guy. And you need him. We all know it's a quarterback league. And the Eagles made a decision several years ago, and it backfired. Because the guy couldn't stay healthy. He's always injured. And I supported them when they signed the contract because I go, well, where do you find guys that are 6'5", that are 230 pounds, that can run and move and have the athletic ability and the arm strength? I would have risked it on that talent. And then I've been thinking about when you're a football player, like luckily for most of us in whatever line of work you're in, I do think you can always improve. You can always gain knowledge. You don't need your physical attributes to carry you, right? We use our intellectual capacity. And that is one area, unlike our body, that you can, you know, in theory, I mean, there are different diseases that can wipe out your brain or whatever, but you can always work on it. You can always gain knowledge. You can always strengthen the muscle, you know, upstairs, right? Physically, with pro sports and pro athletes, only a small percentage of people have the physical characteristics even to do it. And then, as history shows us, you have, unless you're Tom Brady, all-time outlier, most guys 10, 15 years to really strike gold on and off the field while you're playing, right? And you have to improve. Like, I kind of have this theory that a big reason Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and now Aaron Rodgers and Russell Wilson, do you understand why their 30s, and Russell's only a couple years into his 30s, but his 30s are going to be way more productive than his 20s, because of the base of knowledge and work they did in their 20s. You have to improve. You know, this old saying when I worked in the NFL was, the biggest jump a player makes is from his first to second year. And you could argue, some people say the first to second year, and then there have been studies like after your fifth year, you get a little like sixth, seventh year bump. I'm a believer that like that first to like year five is when you build your, if you're going to play a long time, you build your entire foundation for the rest of your career. Study habits, practice habits. And obviously once you build a foundation, you can improve on them. But if you don't have them, I think it's hard to just add those at like 31 when your career is hanging on by a shoestring. So that is a time when you dramatically improve physically, when you just kind of come into your game. And then in your 30s, as you see with Russell, with Rodgers in his 30s, Tom and Peyton, is when you connect it to your mind and it's game, set, match. Well, Carson Wentz has spent his last 4 or 5 years battling these injuries and he's never improved. He's actually, and the old saying is you're either improving or getting worse. Nobody stays the same. If you are not improving as a football player, this sounds crazy, but you're actively getting worse. Because the other people in the league that are improving are passing you. This is like a race, right? You're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. There's no neutral in football. And you could argue there's no neutral in life. You are either actively improving, actively trying to get better, or someone at whatever you do is passing you and waving at you as they go by. But then they get so far ahead, they don't even give a shit about you in the rearview mirror. And I think that's the case with Carson Wentz. I'm just talking about the football player now. He's not that good. Like, I'm watching him play these last 2 weeks, and I go, well, I want this guy as my franchise quarterback, factor in, I got to pay him $35 million. And I say the answer is, without hesitation, hell no. Hell no. I would not want him on my team. Then when you factor in these durability issues, that is out of all of our control. There is not a player, maybe there's a few, but for the most part, in the history of sports, whoever wants to get hurt, nobody wants to get injured. If you ask every player if they could be injured or be healthy, again, small percentage, some guys, you know, like cashing a check in the training room, I think the overwhelming majority of guys in the history of the league would want to play. They do not want to be injured, right? That sounds like common sense. So I don't think he wants to be hurt. Of course not. But for whatever reason, he's one of those guys who just can't avoid it. And when you need him to be there, when you need him to just be available, he often is not. And I think for a long period of time, I'm a sucker for talent like anyone else. I understood going back to Philly why they still looked at him kind of like he had a bunch of ceiling and room to grow. I don't think he does anymore. I think he kind of is what he is. And what he is while he's on the field is not that great. And when you're paying him that much money, if I'm not getting great, I at least need damn good. And I think my voice just cracked. Am I going through puberty at 36? But what damn good is, isn't good enough. And the Colts have a major quarterback problem. And they had one, you know, they band-aided it last year with the high school coach, Phillip Rivers, who, even as he was declining, is to me on a complete, he's a much better player than Carson Wentz. And one thing Phillip Rivers could always hang his hat on is you never had to worry about his availability. He was a durable SOB. And if I ran a team, I was a GM or an owner, and I'm paying a guy all this money, he's the last guy I want to think about. And if you go around the league, like, look at some of the better teams in the AFC, you feel pretty confident. Lamar Jackson, Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, now Derek Carr and the Raiders. Like, every single week, I know that quarterback's going to be there. Now, they've all had freak injuries, right? Mahomes dislocated a knee once. Derek shattered an ankle. An injury happens here and there. This is football. But the amount of injuries, we're at the point now, when I see Adam Schefter tweet he's got, you know, two rolled ankles, I understand why Chris Ballard and Frank did this. They were desperate, and they didn't pay that much. But let's just face it, 2 weeks in, they have a disastrous situation on their hands because the money is the money, but he's just not good enough when he's on the field. And now he might not even be able to be on the field against a massive game, especially with the Titans coming back. It'd be one thing if they were both 0-2. Well, the Titans won. So if they win, they're 2-1 and they beat you and you'd be 0-3. So you'd be two games back of them in the loss column. And I don't know, man. I hate to say this because I was such a big fan probably 3 years ago. I'm out. Like, I'd be out of the car. Now, they got to ride this out this season, but I'll be a little stunned if he's still around next year for the Colts, because when you're not available and you're not that good and you cost a lot of money, that is a bad, bad combination. Okay, let me tell you about my friends at FanDuel. Football season's here. And if you've never bet on the NFL, there's never been a better time to give FanDuel Sportsbook a shot. Because right now, you can place your first bet risk-free. That's right. You'll get up to $1,000 back if you don't win. FanDuel gives you so many bets to choose from. There are same-game parlay bets, player props, futures, and so much more. See for yourself why FanDuel is America's number one sports book. 21 plus and present in Colorado, Indiana, New Jersey, Virginia, or West Virginia. First online real money wager only. Refund issued as non-withdrawable site credit that expires in 14 days. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit fanduel.com/RG. Colorado, New Jersey, Virginia. 1-800-9-WITH-IT, Indiana. Visit www.1800gambler.net, West Virginia. Well, I talked a lot about Zach Wilson and the four interceptions on Monday's podcast. And there is a connection to this guy that I'm going to talk about right now. Because ultimately the Jets, and what you have to do as a football team, and you technically do it with every position every year, is try to determine if the guy you have on your team, you can upgrade. And then you got to factor in compensation, draft picks, salary cap. There are a lot of variables, but on the most basic level, when you work in a scouting department, your job 24/7, 365 is trying to compare available guys or other players to your own team. Can this guy be an improvement? And then you factor in contract status. How do we acquire that player? Like I said, a lot of moving parts. But sometimes you just get a basic move. Hey, we can cut this guy and draft this guy. Hey, we can cut this guy and trade for this player, right? It's like you can choose to get a divorce, but then eventually if you want to have someone in your life, you have to attempt to upgrade from that person. Now, sometimes a relationship is untenable. You don't like each other. It's no different in a business partnership. You can go, I don't want to work, or as an employee, I don't want to work for this, you know, firm or company anymore. But eventually you got to get another job. So you have to balance the risk versus reward, the cost benefit. There's a lot of factors. And as I've aged, I could never relate to this in my 20s. Only really the last couple years. It is, and I've said this a couple times on the show, but as someone now who kind of, you know, on my other podcast, you know, runs it with a partner as a business, you just, in these decisions relative to a lot of big companies, and money's all relative, decisions are not easy. You know, it's so much easier to make suggestions in any business than decisions. And that goes for any of you people listening with kids, right? I mean, as you can tell, I like to talk. For 18 years when I lived at my parents' house, I had a lot of opinions on a lot of things. And looking back, I was probably wrong on 75% of them. No, I was right on some of them, but they were never going to listen no matter what for the most part. So I took a lot of L's. But it's a lot easier being the person just throwing out suggestions than the person that has to pull the trigger and make the decision. And ultimately, the Jets came to the conclusion that Zach Wilson, factoring his contract, using the second pick, was better than keeping Sam Darnold. And potentially using that pick, you know, the Niners wanted to move heaven and earth to get up there. So they could have got a ton, you know, back, you know, in a trade. And as you saw with the Eagles, they easily moved back up to pick six. They could have done some wheeling and dealing. They made that decision. And I have no issue with them making that decision, because eventually you're judged on that decision over a period of time. And we have seen in the history of football a ton of these decisions when it comes to quarterbacks. Teams move on. Teams draft new guys, because ultimately teams want their own guy. How many of you listening right now have worked for a business, you know, where a manager, where a boss, maybe the company was sold and new management comes in? They might keep some people, but in the industries I've been in, they bring in new people. Mainly, they bring in their people. Why? Because there's a trust factor. And when I say their people, when you hire really young people, that guy only knows you. So you kind of get to mold him. And I think a lot of coaches go, if the incumbent, there's some question with him, get rid of him, go with the draft pick, and then you get to teach him and mold him to what your liking is. Belichick has been doing it forever with young coaches. That's why all these coaches that go on to get jobs from him, besides like Bill O'Brien, right? Josh McDaniels, Patricia, Flores, you know, his son one day, Mayo now on his staff. Those guys, their entire coaching career was with Belichick. He gets them in their infancy of their coaching career, molds them, makes them, and creates them, which is awesome for those guys. But he's not into, for the most part, some he'll bring in friends, not bringing in some like 32-year-old that just spent the last 7 years for the Giants. That's not what he does. A lot of coaches and GMs are that way too when they first get a job. But Zach Wilson, which, one, I thought it was a little crazy that they just honed in. They were 100% going to take Zach Wilson and didn't even entertain Fields and Lance. To me, seemed a little crazy, but that was their decision. But I think when you look at Sam Darnold, who he made one really, really bad decision with the Panthers. Against the Saints, watching that game back. But for the most part, I thought he looked pretty good. And then when you take a look at this guy from basically his entire football career, going to college and then going to the Jets, has been in the pressure cooker of the bright lights and basically just been told to save the franchise. That is a lot of pressure. That is pressure that would have folded me. His maturity level at 23 years old, I probably didn't even sniff that till my 30s. I can't even relate. I don't even know what that would feel. I'd probably crumble. I think most people listening would crumble. That is a insane amount of expectations and people just staring at you to give them joy and save what they care about, which the USC football program and the New York Jets, last I checked, those are enormous brands. And when he got there, the Trojans were kind of in shambles. He made Clay Helton. He got Clay Helton an extension. It's not like that guy's a good coach. You got to say this when it comes to Clay Helton. Nice guy, bad coach. Nice guy. Like, we get it. Can we just say, like, assume you're a nice guy? Can we just get to that point? Most people are pretty good guys. You know, why do we have to say with Clay Helton and Andy Dalton, nice guy, nice guy? Yeah, we get it. Like, most of my neighbors are nice. Most people I see are nice. Honestly, let's just call out the shitheads. Be like, asshole. Well, I wish we did that more instead of having to preface with a guy who's not any good that we don't want to criticize. Good guy, though. But the Jets made a decision that Sam Darnold was not good enough and that Zach Wilson ultimately was better. And from what I see of Sam Darnold, you know, he had a little bit of a Jameis Winston quality, I would say, his first couple years in the NFL. It just felt unhinged sometimes, you know? Like, he was not a great decision maker. He would turn the ball over at rapid rates. He couldn't be trusted. But the guy I see with Matt Rhule, he gets to go to just the Charlotte market, which is much more low-key. Joe Brady, we saw him make LSU 2 years ago. Maybe they got something. They have good skill players. McCaffrey's a stud. DJ Moore's a stud. They just got players. Is it crazy to think a guy that we know is mentally tough, because he handled SC when they were shitty and took him to a Rose Bowl. He handled the Jets as best as any human being at 21 or 22 when the team sucked, the coach was a loser, could have, and he's come out on the other end still alive, still keeping his head up. And I'm watching him right now, playing pretty good. Now, is he going to be some top five quarterback? Probably not. But is he a guy that could be a top 12-ish quarterback in the NFL? 100%. They didn't give up that much to get him either. So I get a mentally tough guy who's a really good athlete, who's got a solid arm, that I just have to coach out of the poor decision-making. We saw a couple years ago, Joe Burrow, when he got to LSU, he wasn't any good. And then Joe Brady got him, and they coached him up, and obviously had a lot of talent around him. Sam Darnold does too. And I'm not saying Sam Darnold is going to be what Joe Burrow was at LSU, but I definitely think he could be a player that is good enough to get you to the playoffs. You know, I don't even think that's that crazy at all. And we'll see. I mean, this is not something that, even if the Panthers were to go 10-7 and make the last wild card and the Jets win two games, like, this is not something you just judge on 1 year, but it is something in 3 years we'll have a pretty good idea. Because if the Panthers turn out to be good and Sam turns out to be their quarterback for the next 7 or 8 years, and they extend him here in a year or two, and the Jets are just floundering away in mediocrity and ugly football, I think we'll look back and go, you know, that they might want to have that one back. They might want to redo on that one. I just saw flashes this weekend, very early, not making any bold statements. Don't write this in pen, write it in pencil. Which is something to keep an eye on, though, because I do think Sam Darnold is resurrectable, and I think we've already seen flashes that he might be able to just ride the ship and become the Panthers quarterback for the foreseeable future. Okay, let's look at the tail of the tape. An old school 1970s classic matchup, Raiders-Steelers. And two things jumped out to me, and they both involve quarterbacks. One team has an ascending, improving player, and the other one has a descending, aging, getting worse. I mean, there's no way around it with Big Ben. His arrow is pointing down. Let's start with him. I have hammered this home on this podcast and wherever I speak forever. Most of my life, growing up a sports fan, coming into my own early 90s, for the next 15 years, as I'm growing into one, right, from like 10 to 25, it's like the prime of my sports fandom. When it was pure, you know, now I'm very jaded by all the money and knowing people and what really goes on. But back in the day, it was just pure love of sports. And you would have a favorite player in any of the three major sports. And once he would hit an age, I don't know, about 35, it was over. And he would hold on for dear life, maybe another year or two. But we often said, and we still kind of do, but not as much, partly because of like Tom Brady, age, it's a young man's game, right? It's a young man's game. It still is, but I actually think like 34 is the old 27. So with diets and the progression of health, fitness, wellness, all that stuff, it's clearly changed. But so if 39, like what Roethlisberger is now, is what guys at 34 and 35 used to look like. An old, you know, once great player who no longer is. He can't move. And one of his greatest attributes in his peak was his ability to move, shed would-be tacklers, keep plays alive. Now it feels like when he moves within the pocket or tries to slide like outside the pocket, he's moving in quicksand. Of course he is. He's dramatically slower now. And he's never been in a weird way, Ben was the best version of what Cam Newton, you know, he kind of got that way for a year. I'm not saying Ben ran quite like Cam, but it always felt a little backyard football-y. And he could make these backyard football plays that were just incredible. He no longer can do that. He has to play like Phillip Rivers or Peyton Manning now, even though in his mind, he still kind of thinks he's got some Big Ben type moves, and he doesn't. But he's never been the guy that just played like Peyton Manning and just picked you apart. That was not his game. The Steelers know it. Any fan of the Steelers, you guys now know it. Like, it's over. This is going to be his last season on the Steelers because it's going to be very, very difficult, especially as it gets cold, we've talked about, to win with this guy, especially when your offensive line kind of stinks. It's just, it's going to be tough. Now, they'll be competitive. Hopefully, TJ Watt's okay. TJ Watt would have had like six sacks in that game against Brandon Parker, but he hurt. He got injured and, you know, they missed him. And it changed the game. Because on the other side, you have a guy who's 30 years old who has spent the last 3 or 4 years improving. What did I talk about Carson Wentz? You build that foundation, you know, in your mid to late 20s to then use in your 30s to go with your mind to be an excellent football player. And that's what Derek Carr is becoming right now. An excellent football player. Is he a top five quarterback in the league? Probably not. But is he better than 20 plus quarterbacks in the league? Hell yeah. He is balling. Now, they have fantastic weapons around him. Waller is an elite player. Pro Bowl level game changer. Henry Ruggs is the fastest guy on the field every time he's on the field. And clearly him and Derek are on the same page. Back-to-back weeks. This week they hit a touchdown. Last week they hit a big bomb against the Ravens. He looks awesome. He led the team in targets against the Steelers. He's fantastic. Bryan Edwards, who last year they drafted in the third round, looks fantastic as well. So they have Ruggs. They got Edwards to go with Waller. Jacobs, who gets banged up a lot when he's on the field, their offensive skill guys are dynamite. And when Derek's had dynamite skill guys, in college he had Devontae, they kicked everyone's ass. His first couple years when they got good, he had Crabtree, he had Jared Cook, and he had Amari Cooper. Their offense was awesome. They've kind of gone through this transition. Now it feels like they're pretty stacked. He is very comfortable in this offense. Him and Gruden are very comfortable on the same page. Their offense is awesome. If their defense can just be solid like it has been the first two games, and I don't know, make open field tackles, something the Raiders have always struggled to do, they got a chance to be a playoff team because they have a playoff level quarterback. That's what a playoff level quarterback looks like. Any Steeler fan who attended that game, who watched that game on TV, can agree. Like the difference in that game, we talk about it all the time. It's a quarterback league. One team had a much better quarterback than the other guy. Now, historically, peak Big Ben, like that, your team would have been awesome. If you give me peak Big Ben on this Steeler team, you guys are competing right there with the Chiefs, right there with the Bills, right there with the Ravens. I mean, you're a powerhouse team. I don't think this is sustainable. And I do think the Raiders is sustainable because Derek now has played well for several years and he keeps improving. You have to keep getting better when you're a younger-ish player. Once you get to like Rodgers in his mid-30s, like if I just sustain this, I'm kicking everyone's butt, right? Russell Wilson now, he just has to sustain his level of play. But for those first, when you're building the base of your future career, you have to improve. And that is all Derek is doing week in, week out. And he really has for the last, definitely last year, he played really well. He's still going to have his moments, but you have to. I was texting with a coach today in the league who knows him. And he's like, he needed a coach who was willing to live with some of his mistakes and not be hard on him and just let him be. And he'll be fine because he is like an achiever. He is wants to prove everyone on his own team that he's worthy. He's not, I don't think, ever worried as much about the outside noise. It's like he's, and I've been around him since I've watched him since he was 17 years old. Being a good teammate, being a good, you know, having a good coach-player relationship is very, very important to him. Is very important to him. I think sometimes to a fault. And I think he just found the perfect balance right now of being able to play at a high level, being very comfortable and confident in his relationships within the building, with his coach, with his teammates. And you're seeing a guy who is, you know, through two games, but even last year, Pro Bowl level quarterback play. And he only makes $22 million. So, you know, the way he's playing, like that costs now $38, $40 million. So they kind of have a discount this year and next to kind of utilize this Pro Bowl level player and use some of that money and try to make a run this year. Where the Steelers, you know, you're just kind of stuck with Ben's dead weight. Okay, want to talk about three teams. And two of them are basically directly correlated because they're in the same division. And I said it after the Thursday night game. The Giants aren't any good. Danny Dimes is Danny incompletion, Danny fumble. Even though he did play a good Thursday night game, he's not a very good player. You know, he's just not. He was overdrafted. It's pretty clear that, now it's not all of his fault. Offensive line sucks. Saquon got hurt. But, you know, I think he'll be a guy in 2 years on another team, back up for like Mahomes or Russell Wilson, try to resurrect his career. So be the right move. But I also think when you look at the two teams that played yesterday, it's clear they are better than those other two teams, especially now that Washington's quarterback situation is in the hands of Taylor Heineke, who I kind of like, but I don't know if I like for 15 straight games. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to maintain winning with Taylor Heineke. It's clear when I watch the Eagles against the Niners, who actually showed up ready for a street fight, hit the Niners directly in the teeth. Their young coach made a mistake on the goal line, but overall, I was impressed with Sirianni. His team was ready. They were shoving around the Niners, shoving them around, but they just couldn't execute in the red zone, didn't get points, and it ultimately cost them. The Cowboys, who if their defense just can make some plays, they have so much talent on offense. Hell, they have a $15 million running back, and their backup's a better player. Definitely more explosive. Their talented wide receiver, CeeDee Lamb, Gallup didn't play, but Amari, their tight end, and Dak. Like, their offense is awesome. The Eagles are so good at the line of scrimmage, offensive and defensive line, even though they just lost Brandon Graham, who's a fantastic player, to a torn Achilles. But their offensive line is dominant. Their defensive line, they got about seven guys that would start for most teams in the league. And they have a ton of skill guys. And I don't really trust McCarthy. Sirianni, it's just going to be a work in progress this year. But he definitely, I've been impressed. So I don't know which coach I trust more, which is crazy to say. One guy's a Super Bowl. One guy's coached two games. It's like, I do not trust McCarthy. Though I do like Kellen Moore. Maybe that's a soft spot, being a former WAC Mountain West guy, lover of Boise State football. But I have never been one of those haters on Kellen Moore. I think the division, the NFC East, is going to come down to those two teams. And you know what's fun? That's the Monday night game. Cowboys-Eagles. That's badass. I can't wait. That is a fantastic Monday night game. That's a Monday night game that 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, you know, before the season started, you'd be like, I don't know. Now I'm excited to watch that game. I am very, very excited. Because I think the division, now I don't think either one of those teams, best case scenario, would win 10 games. You might be able to win the division at 9-8, but I think it's those two teams. And we'll get a litmus test. Who's the better team early in the season? And we'll see how it translates. Because I still question the Cowboys' defense. And I just question a little bit the Eagles, just unknown coach, head coach. They have some question marks, I think, on the back end of the defense. But so does every team. I love this. Like, what about our DBs? Most teams don't have great DBs. Let's look at like the best teams in the NFC. Niners don't have great cornerbacks. Seattle, nope. Rams have one. Arizona, nope. The Packers have one. The NFC East, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Bunting's hurt. You know, most teams do not, like, you know, I just roll out peak Darrell Revis and Deion Sanders. That's not the case. If you can win up front, I think your defensive backs can be a little bit overrated. Not your safety play, because they help in the run game and now they cover, you know, running backs and tight ends. Ultimately, receivers are just going to win most games, right? If you can play situational football and hold teams to field goals instead of touchdowns, like, I can live with average DB play. You got to be good up front. And like I talked about on Monday's podcast, Micah Parsons went from stand-up linebacker to defensive end about as seamlessly as I've ever seen a player do it. He looked good. I mean, the Eagles, okay, they lost Brandon Graham. That really sucks. But they just broke off sweat. They gave him $40-plus million. And they already have, you know, other good defensive linemen. Hargraves is a stud. Fletcher's a freaking legend. Like, they got, you know, some pop up front. They drafted Barnett a couple years ago in the first round. They got dudes. So I'm fascinated to watch that game. And the other team, who has started fantastic. I mean, they're 2-0. They are the most entertaining team in the league. But they play a little backyard football. And this guy is the best backyard football player right now in the NFL. It's not close. His talent early in the season when he's fresh and healthy is elite. Kyler Murray right now is dominating. Now, he made some poor throws, poor decisions against Minnesota, but his wow plays, his flat... If I was just making a highlight tape through two games on Kyler Murray, you'd go, this is one of the best players I've ever seen. He has made three or four scramble-to-throw plays that anyone listening that has watched it, jaw-dropping. Especially for such a little guy with such a big arm, so fast. Stupid how talented he is. But I listen, people are going to think I'm a hater, but I'm really not. I promise you. I have no agenda here. I'm not going to buy the Arizona Cardinals because I don't think their style of offense is sustainable later in the season. Their quarterback, he has to prove that he can stay healthy. If he's this healthy all season, they'd have a very good chance. But I don't trust their defense. And philosophically, I don't trust the head coach and what he stands for defensively. Because look at all of his years at Texas Tech. They were arguably one of the worst defenses in the country. And now his time in Arizona, their defense can't be trusted. That game for being a final, I think the final score was 35-33. The only reason the Cardinals won is because their guy hit the 62-yard field goal that would have been good from like 90. Minnesota missed an extra point and missed the game winner from 37 yards. Their kicker can't make chip shots. They're kind of similar teams, except Minnesota's quarterback isn't as sexy. They're very, very potent on offense, and their defenses aren't any good anymore. So you just kind of hold on to your ass. You hope a field goal is going to be the difference in a game, 38-35 or 36-34, and that's ultimately what the game was. But listen, 2-0, you never apologize for being 2-0. I'm just saying, if I was looking at the Arizona Cardinals like a stock, I would not go all in on them. If I had to pick through the NFC West, who has been fantastic, right? Seattle fell apart, weird deal. Derrick Henry took over. But they're going to be fine. Russell and that offense is too good. The Rams are 2-0, but we know that's sustainable because they win the division or in the playoffs, like basically three of the four McVay years. What Cliff Kingsbury has never won a big game. And I'm going to preface this, like I said, with Andy Dalton or Clay Helton. Good guy. I've heard, and I'm going to say this because it feels like I'm picking on him. He is I think I'd be friends with the guy. I would actually love to be friends with him. Probably knows a lot of babes. But I don't trust him as a football coach because I think that offense doesn't translate when the games really matter, because when the games really matter, you usually play better defenses that are more physical. Now, they do have a lot of offensive talent. I will not take that away from him. The Purdue kid, Rondale Moore, I think his name is, number four, he looks awesome. A.J. Green had a sweet touchdown. Hopkins is elite. Their tight end looked pretty good yesterday. Like, they got players in their quarterback. But I saw it last year, same kind of thing. Started fast, and they kind of fizzle. Why? Because that offense fizzles. It happened to Chip Kelly when he was in the NFL. Started fast, then fizzled. Because as the season goes on, November and December, and now I guess that first week in January because of the 17th game, it becomes a heavyweight fight. The games become very physical. You end up playing in some of these outdoor arenas, right? Or stadiums, not arenas. I guess an arena would have a dome. You're playing outdoor. It's cold. The games are going to be lower scoring. It's difficult. And historically, Cliff, in those games, have failed. And I just wonder, I don't wonder, I know where I stand. I'm betting against it happening. Though, they're a very, very entertaining team to watch. Okay, Middlecoff mailbag. At John Middlecoff is the Instagram. Just slide right into the DMs and get your question answered here on the show. Mark. Because of you, I figured out how to use Instagram. I'm 46, so I was holding out my questions about Greer, the GM of the Dolphins. He gets all the credit in the media about being so great. The Dolphins had 3 first-round picks last year. Tua, Austin Jackson at tackle, and Noah something, a cornerback, who has been inactive for the first 2 games of the season. We traded up to get Waddle instead of getting a lineman and signed Fuller, who is out for personal reasons. He drafted Charles Harris at 23 instead of TJ Watt. Not good. What am I missing? We signed and cut McKinney, and we let Van Noy go. We have no running backs. Jordan Howard was an epic fail, and looks like Malcolm Brown will be too. All this wheeling and dealing is meaningless if there's no talent evaluation abilities. Is Greer bad? Yes or no? This is a good question. Christian Wilkins forgot to mention that. Miami Herald just said 44 rushes this year. Wilkins has 1 pressure. Christian Wilkins is not a pass rusher. I think Greer, like Brian Flores, a lot of people like him. They're rooting for him. I think they have a solid team. But ultimately, his biggest mistake, you went into some detail, he took Tua over Herbert. I say it all the time. You can say, well, Middlecoff, every single mock draft, every single media member, every human alive, yeah, he's paid to get that right. He's paid to not listen to those idiots. He's paid to know. He took Tua over Justin Herbert. That alone is a franchise-changing decision. And like you said, last year they had all these picks. Austin Jackson, who was a turnstile on Sunday, and it's just a major project. This year, I like Waddle. Waddle's a stud. But, like, would they have been better off with Penei Sewell? Probably. You know, now, did they try to double down? Right now, the stock market's in shambles. It's an absolute shambles. You know, if you believe in a stock, buy more. It's buying season. But if you don't, I had one that I was going to cash out, you know, decent, you know, over five figures, and I was going to use his capital because it was just clear. Weird shit's happening. It's going to be a weird fall. So just buckle up because it's about to get weird. I wanted to have a little capital to play with it as it gets weird. But there are some stocks that I'm already in on that I'm not going to chase as things dip because I really don't even want to be in. I'm just down in them, so I don't want to sell yet. But if they get back to even, I'll cash out and I'm cool with that. And I think sometimes when you chase, and I think that's what they did with Tua, they chased. Even though, let's face it, deep down they knew. They wanted Deshaun Watson. They wanted out of the Tua after 1 year. Think about that. If Deshaun Watson had not gotten in trouble or going through what he's going through now, he'd be on the Dolphins. Longtime listener, first time mailbagger. Since I know it'll happen this year, I'll ask before it does, what's your opinion on a kickoff to avoid a tie in the NFL? If tied after OT, each kicker kicks in the same direction, starting with 45 yards, and move backs 5 yards each time they make a kick. I mean, how many games come down to a kick anyway? Gotta be better than a tie. Be completely honest, I don't hate that. I mean, can you tell me tied after overtime, which doesn't happen very often, right? I mean, we've probably had three or four ties the last 4 or 5 years. Do you have a kickoff starting at the 45-yard line? Can you imagine if it was a kickoff in like a windy, rainy game? How great that would be? Sign me up. That would be sweet. That would be fantastic. That'll never happen, though. Absolutely zero chance. No way on earth would that ever get, you know, given the go-ahead from the competition committee, the league office. But that would be cool. You know, say one thing about college. It is very entertaining the way they do it, right? You know, first overtime, each person gets the ball at the 25-yard line. I think by the second overtime, now you got to go for two. I think the new rules, I haven't seen this instituted yet, but it definitely got passed the offseason in college. I think in the third overtime, you just start doing two-point conversions. So I'm in. I love listening to your show and the perspective you offer as a former scout. I think the world is starting to finally see that Matt Stafford has been one of the most underrated talents in the NFL for 10 years. If he had Aaron Rodgers and swapped organizations until 2020, would we think of Stafford the way we think of Rodgers and vice versa? Keep up the good work. Congrats on the volume. Craig, I appreciate that, Craig. I don't know. I love hypotheticals. That's a hard hypothetical to do. Obviously, Matt Stafford would be viewed as a much better player than he is right now if he had played for the Packers over that decade. Probably wouldn't be close. It really wouldn't. But would he have been as good as Aaron Rodgers? I don't know if I'd go that far. Aaron's just a better decision maker. Aaron's just, I don't know, I'd have to check the numbers, but clearly more accurate. I think Aaron's just a better player. Now, would Stafford have been just... have multiple playoff wins? Would he be a Super Bowl champion? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe he would. It's just, would Rodgers might have failed. Because remember, unlike Stafford was an elite prospect, no doubt about it, number one player. Rodgers was the 24th pick in the draft. He got 3 years to learn and develop. If the Lions had just taken him in the first round and thrown him into the firing squad that is playing for their team, who knows? Maybe he wouldn't have survived. It's why Rodgers really respects Stafford, because I think he realizes how difficult it is to go through what he went through, to play on that shitty team. I mean, that team sucks. Still kind of does. Question for the mailbag. Recently, I've been testing the waters that are sports gambling. Okay, I like it. A newbie. And I have come to my first real opportunity at guaranteed money through hedging a bet. How often do you recommend hedging bets versus taking the risk of max profit? Well, I have a philosophy of no hedging. Now, I've never been in a situation where I don't gamble for money. I gamble for fun. Now, if I win, as I did this weekend, and get $5,700 on $150, it's awesome. It's really fun. It's cool. But I gamble for the juice. I work for my money. I work for my wages. I get up early. I go to bed late in this streaming podcast game. It's where I make my cash. So if I want more money, I'll do another business deal. I'll try to add a new sponsor. I'll try to generate revenue. That's how my mind thinks. I don't look at gambling as like an extra revenue stream, because I got news for you, it's really difficult. But there is a number. Money's all relative. So if $1,000 is a lot of money to you, and you have the opportunity to win $1,000, and you could hedge $400 to just ensure that you win money, I do it. But if you're just gambling for fun, like if you're gambling to try to add a revenue stream, I can't give you advice, because I don't think about it like that. I look at gambling 100% to entertain myself. When I place bets on teams, I gamble a lot on golf. It's because I want to watch it, and I want to, because I'm going to watch it anyway. So I might as well give myself the opportunity to make a little money. And it's fun. And even when I lose, I mean, it sucks, but I enjoy it. Now, for me, and I don't even know how I would get to this point in like a football game, because I would never put like $5,000 on a game, but it would have to be a large amount of money for me to hedge, because like I don't gamble enough to then win enough to make it worth like, oh, I made a $800 or whatever. And again, money's all relative, but I don't look at gambling like that. So my fundamental belief is I'm gambling for enjoyment. And you lose a lot too, but the enjoyment of just the roller coaster ride makes it fun. My money comes from working. That's the way I look at it. And maybe I'm nuts. Maybe people listen to me like, what are you talking about, bro? Money's money. So again, I'm not claiming to be some genius with this take. It's just how I feel. I hate hedging. I've had a couple opportunities throughout my life, and I haven't done it, and it backfired. And I honestly didn't spend that much time thinking about it, right? I didn't really care. And sometimes a hedge, like if you do a parlay and turn $100 into a couple grand, I get it. But I also go, the way I look at it, if I'm going to have a big return, I go, well, I didn't put that much money down. So I'm hedging, like, what's the worst I'm going to lose? $50, $100, $200? That's my philosophy. Now, if you gamble to try to make real money, then I would always hedge. Like, I hedge in business, you know? I got multiple things going at one time. You know, as a stock investor, I got probably 10 different industries I'm invested in, right? I'm hedging constantly in life. I don't view gambling. I view gambling what sports used to be to me. And don't get me wrong, I still enjoy sports, but it's not the same. Once you work in it, like any job, it just becomes, I don't want to use the wrong vocab word here. It's not monotonous, but it's just, it's different from when I was younger. So it's just, this is work, you know? And I need some entertainment value. That's why I throw a little cash down, just to add the entertainment value. I'm literally paying for some fun. Win or lose, you know? Win or lose. Some people shop for fun. Some people go on vacations for fun. Like, you know, I gamble $1,000 a year on just different events to keep myself entertained on my couch, because I'm going to be watching these events no matter what. That would be my philosophy. I'm sure a lot of people think I'm insane. But hey, maybe I am. Question for the pod. I'm wondering, being Aaron Rodgers isn't happy with the Packers, do you see him getting traded next season? And where would he go? I do not. I see Rodgers back on the Packers. I just think they figure it out. Recording this part before the Monday night game, but I would imagine the Packers won. What's Aaron? What are they going to do? Trade him to Denver? Why are they going to trade him? They drafted Jordan Love. Like, they made a mistake. They're not trading him. he's going to be on the Packers. I feel pretty confident about that. Why don't NFL owners hire coaches and GMs as package deals where they would hire, fire them together? They would choose each other and have the same vision of what the team should become. Why don't teams use, why don't teams use two quarterbacks, one with a big arm who operates outside the red zone, another who is accurate and mobile, who specializes in short yardage and red zone? It would make opponents have more to prepare for. I think on number two, it's just easier to focus on one guy. Let the team rally behind one guy. Let the team focus on one guy. And number one, I mean, ideally you want to hire a GM and a coach together, but sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes you think the coach sucks and you want to keep the GM, and sometimes vice versa. You like your coach, but you want to get rid of the GM. You know, it's easy to say that, but what if you're like, you know, I don't think my GM's any good, but I love my coach. I don't want to fire the coach. Or vice versa. What if you think the GM is like one of the most dynamic guys in the league, but you go, this coach is not good enough. So it's one of those things, in theory, on the whiteboard, 100%. You hire the coach, you hire the GM, same time. In practice, it clearly doesn't happen that way that often. It just doesn't, because we're dealing with humans. And even as an owner who's worth billions of dollars, you have a personal connection to one of those guys, and you're just going to tend to like them more. So I think that's a big reason why it doesn't happen very often. Can you provide some insight into how subbing works in the NFL? I constantly see players coming in and out on offense. I imagine the play caller is deciding the player packages, but how does that get relayed to the players on the sideline quickly and effectively? Do teams ever have certain player packages for certain down and distances? Well, there are names. So on offense, like when I was in Philadelphia, they ran the West Coast offense terminology. So regular personnel, you know, was two running backs, meant a fullback and a running back, a tight end and two wide receivers. Tiger was three wide receivers, one running back, one tight end. So when I scream that out, Tiger, 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 and again, these verbs change team to team, you know if you're part of that package, the three wide receivers, you're in. Same thing on defense. If I call whatever your name for it is, nickel, dime, you know if you're the third corner, you're coming in. You know if you're the pass cover linebacker for a run-stuffing linebacker, you guys switch. The defensive line is constantly coming in and out. And these guys just get used to the substitution patterns, right? If you're, there are only 46 guys dressed on game day in the NFL. So you know if you're a part of the defensive package or not. And then if an injury happens, you just get bumped up. You know, you practice, a lot of these guys are used to it in college, right? Guys coming in and out, different packages. And then specific players, if they're like a niche player, they get three or, you know, get a couple packages, not a ton of plays. And then some players, right? A Keenan Allen, a George Kittle, some of those type guys. I mean, a lot of teams have them. DK Metcalf only come out when they want to come out. Like, they're involved in every package. They call for a sub. But I think it's just pretty basic. You scream out the package, and these guys are used to it in practice, and you go through it in OTAs and then training camp, and then you practice in the preseason. And like I said, these guys are used to it in college, hell, even high school football. And you just know when I scream out whatever the word is, you know, nickel. Well, if you're the third corner or you are a certain defensive lineman, you just shift immediately and you run in and the other guy runs out. And you scream at him when you're coming in and out. And there are coaches helping you. There are people in the box communicating it. It's like a streamlined process. It's part of, you know, it's a lot of moving parts in football. It's why coaching matters so much. Because remember that famous NFL films of Malcolm Butler running in when they call the specific defense? And I think it's Brian Flores screams, Malcolm, Malcolm, Malcolm. And he fires on in there. And then he gets the pick of Russell Wilson. The rest is history. But I think it's one of those things. Good question. It probably sounds more complicated than it actually is. It's like if you're explaining it to someone, you're like, oh, I kind of get it. But then if you were a player or a coach in practice, I think it's pretty easy. Like you just say it and they know. You know, it's like a basic element of their job requirement. And guys are used to it. They expect it. And for the most part, it's a pretty seamless transition. It feels like week in, week out. And this is just a compliment. I don't need to read it. This guy's got a lot of followers, though. Michael, just wanted to let you know that I love your podcast. Raw and unfiltered analysis through the lens of a former scout. Super unique. I appreciate that. I'm going to let you guys get out of here on that. I didn't need to read that compliment, but, you know, when they say compliments are like poison. You can look at them or sniff them, but if you swallow them, they'll kill you. I think that might have been the saying, but it might not have been. I don't know. Something in that kind of realm. I was in the ballpark there. I was in the neighborhood. I appreciate it. I was actually just watching this video Jordan Palmer, Carson's brother, posted about that mental coach who was Russell Wilson's guy, and he worked with all the young quarterbacks. And Russell gave this really good kind of talk, but he was given a press conference last week, and the guy just died. And this guy was huge on just self-belief and talking to yourself much more than like affirmation from other people. It is pretty true. I mean, you got to believe before anyone can believe in you. Like, you need to, you know, all the compliments from other people, they're cool. And in certain jobs, you just get them more than others. But like, to me, the belief, whether you're an NFL quarterback, whether you're the number one sales guy at your firm, whether you're a podcaster, whatever, you got to have self-belief. You got to spend a lot of time, you know, propping yourself up. Because if you don't, you know, the other people aren't going to believe in you. You know, you better believe in yourself first. I don't even know why I'm giving this, how we start talking about this. But, you know, Russell, say what you want, can be cheesy or whatever. The self-belief he's had in himself for a decade, even before he met this guy, he had it when he was at Wisconsin. It's pretty remarkable. And it's a big separating factor for him. And I think it's a big separating factor why he's going to go down as one of the great players in league history. Went third round pick, smaller. It's pretty crazy, right? And I think a big reason he's so upbeat and positive, he's just talking himself into that. Because it's easy, right, to be super negative. I just saw this clip on Twitter about the Oakland PD chief begging people to stop shooting each other. I mean, California's like a war zone. You turn on the news, everything's negative. Stock market's plummeting. It's easy to get negative fast, man. It really is. It's a challenge. I know I fight it. I'm human. On a daily basis, to not be negative, to not go down dark rabbit holes, to stay positive, to stay focused on what you want to accomplish, on what you want to do, on getting better that day, on, you know, some of the cliche bullshit, but it is kind of true. Because I'll tell you this, I wouldn't want to spend 1 minute around negative fucking Nancys in life. I'd rather swan dive off the Golden Gate Bridge than be around miserable people. I try to avoid them like the plague. Now, sometimes you run into them on social media, but in your real life, being around positive, I'm not talking like fake positive. I'm just talking about like upbeat, optimistic human beings. And there are a lot of them in football, but it also can turn negative quick too. But I, you know, try to actively be optimistic and surround yourself with those type of people. Just so much easier to enjoy life. Can you imagine being miserable? And trust me, I got some miserable tendencies in my own head. I'm not perfect here. I fight them. But it is not a way to live, man. Be happy. Force yourself to be happy. Or at least just positive. Maybe happy is the wrong word. I'm not a huge fan of the word happy. I think positive is a better word. Try to be positive. And in this day and age, especially younger people, you just social media, man, can be a dark place. Holy moly. Okay, have a great week. And yeah, I'll see you guys Friday. Peace.
The volume.